This is Janet Driscoll-Miller, author of Data First Marketing, How to Compete and Win in the Age of Analytics. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Janet Driscoll-Miller to talk about the book she has co-authored with Julia Lim, Data First Marketing, How to Compete and Win in the Age of Analytics, published by Wiley. Janet Driscoll-Miller is a digital marketing expert, writer, and keynote speaker. She has nearly 30 years of digital marketing experience and founded the digital marketing agency Marketing Mojo in 2005. She's worked with many top-tier clients, including National Geographic, Mazda USA, LexisNexis, and Activision. She is a regular guest lecturer at the University of Virginia, go Wahoos, and James Madison University, her alma mater, go Dukes. She previously authored a book on Google Analytics, Getting Started with Google Analytics, How to Set Up Google Analytics Correctly from the Beginning. And interesting fact, outside of digital marketing, Janet is passionate about women's rights and building the next generation of female leaders. And she is an active supporter of the Girl Scouts, serving as a troop leader, camp volunteer, and trainer. Janet, congratulations on Data First Marketing and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas. It's great to be here.
So we both live in Virginia, and for you people in the UK, Virginia is actually named after Queen Elizabeth I. Go look it up. We both have daughters named Emma, I learned from reading your book, and you are the very first graduate of James Madison University that I have had on the Marketing Book Podcast, and I have a real soft spot for JMU because my son is a recent graduate.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Now, how is it that everybody that's from JMU is so nice?
You know, that's one of the reasons I chose to go to school there.
Really?
It was fantastic. Yeah, when I went on the tour, everyone was so friendly. It just seemed like a great place to be.
Yes. And they're very attractive people at JMU, according to my son. And that's why, you may not know this, Janet, but I have the best-looking audience in all of podcast land. I did some research, and I over-index on JMU grads, which only makes sense because, you know, they're such attractive people. Now, you are going to give a book away to a listener. So, listener, you're going to get a chance to win a book, and we're going to have the details after the interview. Come on, I'm not going to tell you how to do it right now and then lose you as a listener. But I wanted to read a couple of endorsements of your book, and they're all from past guests on the Marketing Book Podcast. So I'm a big fan of theirs, and my listeners are too. David Merriman Scott, who's the best-selling author of The New Rules of Marketing and PR and about 10 other books. And that book, actually, one of the first editions, is one of two in my career that have had the biggest impact. And he is the patron saint of the Marketing Book Podcast. He was the very first guest, and I've interviewed him 6 times. He wrote, "This is the book I wish I had back when I was trying to communicate with the sales VP. But more than that, this is the book that would have gotten me speaking the language of the CFO and the CEO and the board of directors. Data First Marketing is a deep dive into how to understand modern marketing in our new age of analytics. And Anne Handley, who everybody loves, she is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of Everybody Writes, and she's also the chief content officer at Marketing Profs. She wrote, "Data First Marketing is like personal training for you and your marketing team. Your programs will emerge brawny, strong, buff, and fit to defend themselves from any doubters, haters, or bullies who doubt marketing's true value." She's such an incredible writer, and I would encourage everyone to sign up for her fortnightly newsletter that comes out on Sundays at annhandley.com. It's wonderful. And also Tim Ash, who was on here on the podcast not too long ago. He's the author of Unleash Your Primal Brain, which I interviewed him about. He's also the author of Landing Page Optimization. He wrote, "It's a detailed guide to unlocking the full value of your company's marketing data." Written by industry veterans, this book is a must-read for online marketers at agencies and within companies. And Janet, as you may know, Tim lives in San Diego.
Yes.
He is a close personal friend of Ron Burgundy's.
Yeah. Yes, and he likes to, I laud it over the rest of us who don't live in sunny San Diego right. when the weather is really nice there.
Yeah,
we're in Virginia in the blizzards.
Right. Yes, he does that, but we love him. So before we get going, I don't want the word analytics, and data first to scare listeners off. There are some really important reasons why folks should listen to this interview. Marketers should. This book is not a book for arts and crafts party planners who work in the make it pretty department. That's a term I often use for marketers who are either, they're in a situation where the company doesn't appreciate what they're doing. Actually, they might want to do it, but this is for the modern marketers. And honestly, I don't think I upset anybody by saying that just now, because I don't think arts and crafts party planners even listen to this podcast or any marketing podcast. They're just going to be left behind, and we're going to talk about that. I wanted to mention a couple things, like just a couple of gems in here about why this is so important and what a big opportunity this topic is for marketers. I'm going to quote from page 42, where you write, "Adopting data-first marketing not only positions marketers for success now, but also develops valuable skills that are scarce and will be increasingly sought after in the job market as all companies will go down this path." And there was another gem from your book. It's so quotable. You write, "Traditional marketing isn't dead. Rather, digital marketing has transformed our discipline into something more, something better, and something both easier and harder at the same time." But wait, there's more. We talk about traditional marketers. You write on page 3, "Marketing leaders who think that the field is the same and that digital marketing is just a new set of tools and channels to explore will lose out to those who understand that there has been a fundamental change to marketing that must reverberate through the people, processes, and technology that make up how marketing is accomplished in each company." Hold on. Two more. You write, "With marketing," on page 5, "with marketing data analytics, these marketing leaders can clearly show the rest of the business just how important marketing is to overall business success with metrics that prove it." And one other thing on page 184, for those playing the home game, is you write that the most difficult skill to hire for right now is marketing analytics. And the last thing I want to mention, which of course got my attention because I was at one time in the Army, you write, "Data is the new marketing battlefield. From the information that potential buyers provide about themselves on social media or on your digital properties to the quantitative results you have on your sales and marketing operations. In the age of analytics, it is this data captured, filtered, and interpreted intelligently using the lens of your unique business goals that can create competitive advantages for any business and showcase the true value of what marketing can and should be." So I want to read from a couple of excerpts about the book, and then I'm going to be quiet for most of the rest of this interview, except to ask a few questions. Sorry to dominate the conversation here, but as a one-time English major, you had me at Samuel Taylor Coleridge on page 109, where folks who know the famous poem rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, you start one chapter with water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. And then the next page you write, the quote above refers to a sailor who is surrounded by salt water and is unable to drink any of it. If you can think about data as water, we are taking you on a journey in this book to help turn it from salt water to something you can actually consume. And then a couple other things just to set the stage for the conversation. In the preface, and there's a section by Janet and a section by Julia, in Janet, you write, today, the wealth of information available to us as marketers can seem overwhelming. I encourage you instead to think of the data available as an opportunity. I wrote this book with Julia to help clarify where disconnects exist between the marketing team and the rest of the company and to help close that gap. I wrote it so that other marketers can see the value that marketing data brings to strengthening your positions and reinforcing the marketing team's value to the organization. I've added many actual examples to illustrate mistakes as well as fantastic successes when the right data is implemented and utilized correctly in an organization. I hope we can help you create a dynamic shift in your company and solidify the value that your marketing team brings to your organization. And then a couple pages later, Julia writes, like the advent of digital marketing before it, marketing data analytics will be a sea change for the field of marketing. And we hope that this book helps you navigate it. And just two more I wanted to mention. On page six, you write, we wrote this book to help marketers just like us and just like our clients, as we all must make this transformation to embedding data and analytics in our daily work lives. Like all major change, it's not comfortable and it's certainly not easy, but it will be absolutely worthwhile the next time your CEO asks about a campaign. And in addition to showing a picture of the creative, you can show a chart that shows new leads, new pipeline, or new revenue that can be tracked back to that campaign. And finally, on page 12, you write, we live in the age of analytics surrounded by data, but that doesn't mean that we have the right mindset, skills, and experience to use it in our daily marketing tasks to do more, faster, better. We know we should be pushing toward a data-driven marketing model, but what does that really mean for our marketing teams, and how can we get there? In this book, we try to answer these questions and define a data-first marketing strategy that is achievable by everyone from large company to single-person business. And that, first and foremost, ensures you never have to settle for volume metrics to show marketing's value to the business. So, Janet, you write at the very beginning of the book that the chief marketing officer is under attack and that the uncertainty surrounding the role of the CMO today is a reflection of the difference between marketing and what business leaders think marketing could and should be. Can you explain that situation we're in?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm at the age where I was very fortunate in my marketing career to get started right as the internet was getting started. And so I've grown with digital marketing from the beginning of my career.
And didn't you have a computer as a child? Your dad worked for Siebel?
He worked for Sperry Univac.
Well, Sperry Univac, that's right.
Yeah, and so I had a computer from a young age, and my dad sat me down when I was in fifth grade and tried to teach me binary, ones and zeros, at the kitchen table.
Yes.
I've always been sort of a techie nerd person who loved computers.
This is your podcast.
Yeah.
Welcome
absolutely.
Home.
Thank you. And but it, you know, really, I was one of the fortunate marketers, but I know many people who are my age and older maybe didn't benefit from having that early marketing experience with digital marketing from an early start in their career. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a little bit challenging moving from traditional to digital. But that's definitely been a challenge that we've seen. And CMOs, who are probably typically my age or older, or around this age, may not have had that experience. And so often trying to run teams that they may not have the personal experience in gaining this data themselves, gathering it, understanding how all the parts of the digital piece work. And that's been a real challenge for them, I think, to know how to hire, how to manage. So it's been a real difficult transition for many folks in marketing leadership.
Can you say more about what business leaders think marketing could and should be? Because some might argue that a lot of companies don't know what is possible with modern marketing. Are you seeing it the other way around, where they're having to try and push or pull the marketers to keep up?
I think you're correct in saying that they don't always know what's available to them. And in some cases, you see the opposite end of that spectrum, where some business leaders, like the CEO and so forth of the company, may not understand why you can't measure something directly. There's always an assumption with digital that you can just measure anything digital, but that's not always the case. And it can be very difficult to tie those attributions together. So I think you get both ends of the spectrum. You get both CEOs who may think that everything digital is measurable, and then you get some folks who don't know what can be measured and don't know the opportunity. And so they look to marketing to just measure what they think is the right thing, but marketing doesn't always marry what the business wants, the business's goals, with what marketing is doing. And that's a real disconnect that needs to be solved.
Well, talking of measurement, you write that marketers are seduced by volume metrics. I loved how you phrased that. So as it relates to marketing proving its value to businesses, can you explain the difference between what you call volumetric versus value metrics?
Absolutely. So value metrics are metrics that absolutely tie back to the company's goals, which are typically going to be centered around revenue generation. And that's what your company cares about. Lead generation, revenue generation, opportunity generation, that type of measurement. Whereas a lot of times what we see in marketing, we have our own set of metrics. And it's okay to have these metrics, but they really don't mean as much to the company. So for instance, things like shares and likes, while they may make us feel really good about ourselves as a marketing department, they really don't inform us as to how well our brand is doing with gaining revenue. They're not really KPIs to indicate whether or not we're going to make money off of these folks who are sharing and liking. So that's really a bit of the challenge. And I don't mean to just to single out social media like shares and likes. There are many types of volume metrics like this that marketers use to say, hey, I feel good about the work that we did, and I feel like it's making a difference. But those metrics don't really usually equate back to what really matters for the company, which is the generation of revenue.
Right. You talk in the book about using metrics that marketers have always been using, but don't actually contribute to winning. And this may hurt some feelings, like email open rates or
exactly.
Website traffic. But let's back up for a minute. I have a sense that you and Julia might be baseball fans, because you talk quite a bit about the bestseller Moneyball by Michael Lewis, which was also made into a movie. Can you talk about the lessons that that book, Moneyball, offers for marketers today?
Yeah, I think one of the best takeaways from that movie, if you haven't seen it or haven't read the book, the movie is about a true life story, and the book's about a true life story. I believe it was the Oakland A's, that they didn't have a lot of money as a team. They were not a rich team. They were not the Yankees, right? The Yankees have a huge payroll, and they're able to afford a lot more. But what they had to do was become smarter with the money they had. And so they debunked basically the traditional thinking around recruiting a team and creating a team, instead of always going for the heavy hitters, the people who had the most highest payroll, the best most
home runs or something,
right, like the highest paid folks in the industry, the players in the industry. They instead said, well, let's look at some statistics about some of these guys, and let's create a team that is going to holistically work together to achieve our goals. And they were very, very successful at it. And so much so that you see data analytics all over the place in about every sport now. And if you're not doing it, you get left behind in sports. So it was really revolutionary what they were able to achieve. And I think what it proves to us as marketers is that you can be the little guy. You don't have to have the biggest marketing budget, and you can still win by using data to your advantage.
Yes. And the thing I hadn't read that book. I think I've seen the movie. Such a great story. I was not aware of how much pushback they got from their industry, and for how many years there were a lot of people saying that's nonsense. In other words, like all the scouts, this was a real threat to all the scouts that said, no, I played baseball. I know how to go to the stand and watch these people. I know how to pick them. And the data folks at the Oakland A's were saying, well, that's good, but this data indicates, I believe it was on base percentage. So they were looking at players that could just get on first base. That seemed to be the straw that stirred the drink, and it did. But it was so interesting. And that's actually where you mentioned like open rates and website traffic. Those are things that marketers continue to report on, but which really, you know, maybe more like the single home runs out there, because they've just always been doing that. And also, I suppose that whatever technology you're using to measure something like email or your traffic, it's information that's presented to you, so you report it without thinking about necessarily why.
Well, the other challenge is that a lot of those metrics aren't necessarily terribly accurate either. You know, if it's something like an open rate as an example, it's a really good example of something that's not necessarily a valuable metric because of the way it's measured. Open rate is typically measured by a pixel showing up in an email. And so if that pixel, like for instance, I'll give you an example. I use Outlook as my email platform, and I have a preview pane and I can see my emails. I didn't technically open and read that email, but the pixel may load in my preview pane without me actually consuming the email. And so open rate isn't really 100% accurate in understanding whether or not someone actually consumed your email and read it. And so that's the other challenge with some of these metrics, is they're not really accurate in many cases.
So other than what I mentioned of maybe that's numbers that are easily accessible or they've always been doing it, why do marketers still use these metrics on the reports and dashboards that show, you know, how their programs and campaigns are doing?
Well, without sounding too radical here, or I don't want to upset too many people, but the reality is, I think that some marketers are really afraid, number one, of being accountable. So they are afraid to go after the really heavy hitting metrics that mean something to the company, like revenue, or they're not sure how to get there. You know, we all talk about being data driven, but it's great to be data driven, but you got to be using the right data that really is an indicator of whether or not you're going to be successful as a marketing team. You know, and if email open rates aren't that metric, then what is the right metric? And I think that there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of worry about being accountable, but I think, you know, in the end, you know, if you take that journey, you take that step of being accountable and really creating the right measurements, not only will your marketing be more effective, marketing can be the hero of the organization instead of being looked upon as sort of an expenditure that's just, you know, the first thing to be cut when there's budget issues.
Oh, yes. And this is for the listener to understand. This is not a long book and it's not written in binary code, but it will get you such enormous respect, and I think it'd be great for your career. And now it's not easy. I just want to close that thought out. You're right. Before you show any metric to the CEO and CFO, you need to ask, why does that matter? Because if you think they wouldn't ask the same question, you're only fooling yourself, and perhaps only in the short term. That's such a great thing to put on any kind of, we just did one this week for a client, analytics report, you know, and the more that somebody is in the room saying, okay, now tell me again why that matters to somebody that doesn't pay a lot of attention to this. So let's move ahead. I want to talk about transforming your marketing organization. I want you to explain something here. I want to quote from page 41, which is, too often data-driven marketing is still considered as an add-on, utilizing data analysis resources residing outside of the marketing function instead of being used every day by marketers themselves. Most data-driven marketing is reactive and not strategic, applied after campaigns are executed instead of being incorporated from the beginning of setting strategy and goals. It's a nice to have instead of a must have. It's no wonder that data-driven marketing is still marginalized. And in order for data-driven marketing to succeed in any organization, again, this is the hard part, there must be a fundamental transformation of the marketing function. So let's step back in case somebody accuses me of not asking you, what is data-first marketing? We mentioned the term data-driven marketing, but explain what data-first marketing is.
Sure. So data-first marketing is really putting data at the forefront before you even execute a campaign. It's really using that data from the beginning of the campaign and measuring it throughout the campaign, different metrics to help you understand the success or failure of a particular campaign. And so we talk a lot more about that in our campaign framework as well, but we want to make sure that the data that we're measuring from the beginning of the campaign is something that can track back to the business goals, ultimately the business goals. So that's what we want to measure from the very get-go. And we want to set up our campaigns from the very beginning with that measurement in mind, because the problem becomes when you only measure at the end of a campaign and you haven't thought through all the measurements that you might want to yes. capture, then it's too late. When you realize that at the end of the campaign, oh, I wish I'd captured XYZ metric. Well, if you didn't plan for that in the beginning and didn't set up your campaigns properly, you won't have that data at the end to gather. And so that's really critical.
Yes. And at the end of the book, page 166, I'm such a nerd, I know the page, I have it written down, but you talk about how KPIs should be determined prior to the start of a campaign. It couldn't be clearer, and the book explains why you need to determine beforehand what you're going to measure. So David Merriman Scott, in a foreword to the book, he wrote, "Many of the concepts this book has put forth may seem like common sense, but if the concepts were so simple..." Why haven't marketers right. done it? Yeah, like we were just talking about. So I just want to quote. I just love this. I think the listeners like it. You, there's one section on page 43. You say, why isn't marketing already doing this? And you write, if everyone knows that they should be moving to a data-driven model to make smarter decisions faster, then why aren't they doing it? We covered some of this in chapter 2, which is the lessons from Moneyball. People default to doing what they've always done, especially if everyone else seems to be doing it that way as well. Most marketers answer what and how many, but tend not to answer why, which go on to write, and this is what I want you to talk about. You say that based on having worked with many client marketing teams in a variety of industries, you found two additional obstacles that any marketer will understand and commiserate with in terms of why marketing hasn't been doing this that much.
Yeah, it's ultimately that you're too busy. Marketers, when I look at, we share something in the book, Scott Brinker, who is also a great author. Mm-hmm. He shares every year, he used to run a blog called MarTech, and he would share every year a chart he made with logos on it of all of the different marketing measurement tools out there that we could be using in marketing. And if you look at this graph, this image, there are so many logos on it, you can't even decipher one of the logos. You can't even really read it because there's so many. There's over 5,000 products. And you think about us as marketers trying to manage all the things we have to manage. We're just so inundated. There are so many platforms we need to be participating on, or we think we need to be participating on. There are so many demands on our time. It is really, really challenging. We're all really busy. So how do you carve out the time to put data first? How do you begin to do that? That's a real challenge. And then it's not easy. It's, you know, you really have to.
It's hard.
If it were easy, everyone would do it and everyone would be great at it. But I think you and I had talked before, it's like being a professional athlete. You can't expect to just jump in tomorrow and be, although I will say the young lady who won the silver or bronze in the marathon this year, it was her third marathon. So that was pretty impressive. But wow. Not everyone is like Molly Seidel. Not everyone is going to be able to jump in and be that successful immediately in the Olympics. But most people have to train for years and years and years to get to that type of level. And so it's no different with marketing. We have to crawl before we walk. There's lots of pieces to put into place. So it is hard. And what we suggest is you just take it step by step. Don't try and eat the whole elephant at one time. Let's just take one bite at a time.
Yes, please, marketers, do not beat yourself up. It's a journey. It's not some light switch that you turn on. And that is actually a great transition into the marketing maturity model that you have in chapter 4. And it shows, like I say, it's not an A-B. It's not an on or off. it's perfectly explained when you say it's a cultural transformation. And you're going to get there. And the secret of getting ahead is just getting started. And I just wanted to read these from page 51. In your model, you have five sections. And they on the page, it shows a graph going from the lower left up to the upper right. So in other words, it shows growth up and to the right, as they say. And the first one is novice, okay? And you describe it very succinctly. Marketing is data impaired. Lack of access to data, data in silos, and lack of cooperation within the organization. Marketing is not measuring to ROI or revenue. Okay. The second one is aspirational. So the next one shows a little bit more of an advancement. And as I read these, think about where you are in your organization. And any of these is fine. Marketing has access to its own data, but other organizational data remains siloed. Marketing is preparing reports as a team, but can't necessarily report on ROI or revenue. And then the third one, you describe it as competent. Marketing has access to revenue data from the CRM, allowing ROI calculations. Marketing and sales communicate and track data together. They have common definitions of sales qualified leads, for instance. And the fourth one is advanced. Each campaign has a quantitative measurement goal. Content is mapped to the personas and the customer journey. Experimentation and testing are regularly performed. And the last one, the king of the hill, the stairway to heaven, data-first marketing is pervasive throughout the marketing team. CMO is a strategic partner in the C-suite and helps define organizational goals. Now, the survey that you have in the book is worth the price of the book, where you can go through these five sections and score yourself. And you can do it privately, so you don't have to announce this to everyone. And let me just tell what the different sections are. But this is, again, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. The first section is aligning marketing within the business. And there's 12 questions on there, and you score yourself. The second one is the architecture and the technical resources. The third is analyzing the data. The fourth is the campaign framework, which we're going to talk about. And the fifth one is embracing data first. And that has more to do with the cultural transformation, which we won't have quite as much time for. But the first one, aligning marketing with the business, it's got these 12 questions. And Janet, I don't know if I'm right or not, but as I read through this, these first 12 questions, it almost seemed irrelevant what some of the later scores were, because if you don't have what's in this first part, it really seems like you're going to have some tough sledding ahead. Is that your experience?
Exactly. Well, and that's part of the reason if you look at the scoring, you'll notice it says for highly agree, it's 5, somewhat agree is 3, not sure is 0. It just jumps down to 0, and disagree is 0. We discussed this a lot. Julia and I were discussing the scoring model quite a bit because we said, well, do we want 2 zeros in there? It doesn't really necessarily make sense. But the reality was if you didn't have these things in place, then you weren't on even a gradual step on that particular question. You know, you could, if you somewhat disagree that you're not agreeing on your SQLs with the sales department, then you're not there. So, yeah, I would say that certainly, you know, part of this is really important to be working with the sales team. We talk about that later in the book. We have a lot of talk about relationships in the organization, where you have to get this data from. And sales is perhaps the most important other group in the organization that you need to get this information from and work with very closely. And unfortunately, I think for so long we've seen marketing and sales often butt heads and not get along. And this has always been a conversation in marketing about how do we work together. But there's in many organizations I've worked with, the teams are very separate and segregated and siloed, and you can't. Really, the marketing, I know some marketers will not like to hear this. The marketing team's job, and I'm a marketer, but it's our job is to serve sales. It is to give them what they need to make the sale. So if we're not doing that, we're not communicating with sales, how can we deliver them what they need?
I don't know. And it's one of my favorite topics, and there haven't been that many books written about marketing and sales alignment. There have been 2 on the show, but if you start to do what's in this book, you're going to sneak some sales and marketing alignment into your organization.
Yeah.
don't go promise that, but you're going to start to notice that. But I have to do this. I just wanted to read the 12 questions because if you don't buy the book, if you don't get anything else, just think about these questions. These are like the foundation of a house you're about to build. I think a lot of marketers and organizations jump to some of the later things, like the roof, before they get to this. So it was like, marketing is perceived as a revenue center as opposed to a cost center in our company. That is the first question. And I'm going to follow that up with another question. Number two, marketing is viewed by the entire organization as providing a high degree of value to the business. You can see how that's related to the first one. Third, marketing strategy is aligned with and built from business strategy. That's one I don't see when I talk to a lot of marketers out there. Some. Four, marketing clearly aligns its objectives and goals with the company's objectives and goals. And we're going to talk about that. Number five, marketing and sales are strongly aligned. Six, there is a clear definition of a marketing qualified lead. There's a clear definition of a sales qualified lead. And the team shares agreement on sales qualified lead definition. That's number eight. Number nine, the marketing team works directly with sales to define accounts to target. Marketing leadership actively seeks input from sales leadership when developing marketing strategy. Marketing has access to the sales data we need to report on opportunities and close deals. And the last one is, I have a high degree of confidence in the accuracy of sales data. So back to the cost center versus revenue generating center. If marketing is perceived as a cost center, which I can't remember, there may be a statistic where like half of all businesses think that anyway, if I read that right. What metrics can the marketing team start to provide that demonstrate more success? I mean, you've already mentioned some of these activity or volume-based metrics, but what are the things that they could be more specifically talking about?
Well, in part, you know, and if when you have that sales and marketing alignment and you're sharing data, and every organization's a little bit different. I've run across organizations where the sales team didn't want to provide the data back to marketing. But when we have that data as a marketing team, we can show the sales team how our work is affecting them and their ability to gain leads. So, you know, if you think about any CRM, it typically will have leads, opportunities, and closed deals. Those are just some minimum things that you see in a CRM. And so tying our and attributing our work and marketing to how many leads are generated, how many of those leads were qualified, how many became opportunities, how many opportunities were won, and the value of those opportunities, because ideally sales should be entering this data as they learn more and they are updating the CRM. The value of those opportunities, what was the potential contract value? And then closed won and closed lost, understanding both of those. And I always tell people closed lost is just as important as closed won, because you want to know why you lost.
Yeah,
you
want to
know
how.
Yeah, exactly. And if you found that, gosh, you know, I got a lot of folks from this one channel through the process and they got to the end and we lost all of them, then there's a question there. Marketers need to understand, well, maybe that's not the right channel for us because we lose all those deals. So closed won, closed lost, and understanding the value is really, really key. The further you can get down that continuum, the better. So you can start with leads and then go to opportunity and get as much data as you can as a marketer back from the sales department so you can demonstrate, here's how many leads we brought in, here's how many opportunities we bring you. And when you can tie that back to specific channels and campaigns, then you as a marketer know what is most successful. How can I drive more of that to my sales team?
Well, now when the sales team doesn't want to share these kinds of things, that sounds to me like a cultural issue. What has to happen then? It comes from the top, the leadership that has to step in and help to get folks cooperating?
It really does. And so ultimately, if you're having trouble with the sales team not providing that data, your first place to go is your VP of sales, your chief sales officer, whoever's leading up sales, because of course, salespeople are incentivized. And many times they'll have a weekly sales meeting, they'll be talking about pipeline. if the head of sales, whoever that, whatever their title is, helps enforce in those pipeline meetings, this data must be updated, this data must be shared, you have a much better chance of getting it. So if you're having difficulty with the sales team, that's a place to start. But if you find that the head of sales is also not cooperative, I'm going to tell you right now, knock on the CEO's door, because the CEO definitely cares about these metrics. And if the sales team refuses to give you the data you need to be successful and to give them more leads, the CEO wants to hear about that.
There you go. There you go. Now, if the CEO doesn't want to hear about it, update your resume.
So yes, exactly.
You talk about, let's talk a little bit more about the sales, because I want to quote from page 72. You write, "While each of the company stakeholders plays a role in how marketing is perceived and the involvement marketing may have in the development of the company's strategy, goals, and objectives, perhaps none is more important and immediate than marketing's relationship with sales. Changing sales perception of marketing and proving the value of marketing efforts depends on marketing's quantitative measurement of meeting our sales goals. First, marketing must truly achieve alignment with sales." So let's talk a little bit more about that. What are, I mean, we talked about insight into the pipeline, but what are some of the other things that, you know, basics that really need to happen in order for sales and marketing to be aligned?
Sure. I would say, you know, first off, because we want to measure to marketing qualified leads and sales qualified leads, we need to be having a common shared definition of what an SQL is. Mm-hmm. Because I see in many organizations where the sales team has their own idea of what a qualified lead is, and marketing has a separate idea of what that is. And so you're not measuring to the same metric.
And you know what that leads to sales saying to marketing?
What's that?
"The leads are weak."
I love it. I love it. Yeah, absolutely. And so in order to start that conversation, that's a good idea to bring in sales and ask, say, how can we define this sales qualified lead and marketing qualified lead, mm-hmm. that we, a definition we both agree on. And it also means regular communication and sharing of data. Because again, we as a marketing team need to see things like which leads were qualified, which ones were not qualified. Because when we see that data, we're going to be able to serve the sales team better and give them better leads. If we find we're getting a lot of unqualified leads from a particular campaign or channel, we should shut that off. I tell marketing people all the time, a lot of times we measure to conversion, and that's great. And then we feel like our job has stopped. We had a Google campaign, we advertised, and we got a conversion on it. That means somebody signed up their lead, fantastic, our job is done. It's not done. In fact, what ends up happening is you don't know what happens after that conversion. What if Google sent you 100% unqualified leads? You know, sure, they filled out a form and downloaded your asset or signed up for a free trial, but if they never become customers, you need to know that. And that's information that sales holds. So mm-hmm. we really have to have that regular communication to understand how we can do a better job using the marketing dollars we have and channeling them to the right area, the right platforms, and right campaigns.
You mentioned the conversion word. It reminds me of a funny story. Years ago, I was on a panel discussion in Washington, D.C. about social media. And, you know, all kinds of things were being talked about. And afterwards, this gentleman came up to me and he said, "You know, I understood everything you were talking about as it relates to digital marketing, and I was with you until you started talking about religion." And I said, "Boy, I don't remember talking about religion. What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, you started talking about conversions. You started about talking about converting."
Nice.
Okay. Anyone that's still listening, that's not what we're talking about. One other thing. So we talked about, you know, some of the key metrics, like the CEO is important to them, and certainly the sales leadership. There's another one I wanted to mention here, though, about the finance folks. This was very interesting from page 85, where you write, "By transforming marketing from cost center to strategic partner and revenue center, the marketing team will have more influence and input into the overall strategic direction of the company. However, perceptions aren't going to change unless marketing establishes a better relationship with finance and provides measurable financial impact for the organization. Many marketing teams still do not have a close relationship with finance, with more marketers responding, quote, 'We speak only when forced to,' end quote. than marketers responding that finance is a strategic partner. And you go on to quote Debbie Gagish, who's yet another person I've had the honor of interviewing. And she says, marketing must speak the language of finance. She says, the CFO and CMO speak two different languages if marketing is not a revenue marketing organization. The CFO speaks the language of business, cost, revenue, bookings, and forecasts. A traditional marketer is speaking the language of creative impressions and traffic. No one, especially the C-suite, cares about the colors of the website. When a marketing organization is focused on revenue marketing, you will find the CMO and the CFO speaking the same language. I guess I should have read that with a real Southern accent because she's an Auburn graduate. So, Janet, moving on, let's talk about psychology, which, believe it or not, you cover that in the book too. What are some of the, as you say in page 110, what are some of the common data fallacies that marketers have a tendency to fall back on, and all of these that you mentioned, I'm just as guilty as anyone. I think the first one you talk about are these cognitive biases.
That's right. Yeah. So cognitive bias, we see it even in Moneyball, where you have also confirmation bias as well. Mm-hmm. The tendency to search for and use information that is basically pre-existing in your mind on a topic. So you can think that you know everything on a topic because humans just naturally are using what they have learned over time and trying to make decisions off of that. And so that cognitive bias almost prevents us in some way from always learning new things. And so when we look at data, it is really easy for us as marketers to look for data that proves what we think to be true. And we want to believe it's true. And so you have to be really careful and use an objective eye when you're looking at your data and not just be trying to prove what you think to be true, but actually be ready to accept what may be disproving what you think is true. Mm-hmm. And be open to that. And I think that can be difficult for some marketers, but it's human nature. It's one of those things that we just have to be aware of and overcome as best we can when we're doing it. So looking at that data, being really fair to the data and not just using it to prove only what our pre-existing notions are about a particular campaign or marketing effort.
Yes, and that section of the book, you talk about your own firm, the agency, where there was a trade show and you all had heard that it wasn't very good and everybody said it was bad. But yet you all went to it and tested out some things and it was wonderful. You had great results, and yet you were thinking, no, this won't work. Well, how do you know unless you do it correctly? And also, not that this is about trade shows, but I think there are a lot of people that don't do trade shows correctly. They don't do a lot of planning. They just, they lease a space and think that people are going to come up and hand them money. Another one that you talk about that's, I see so often is you talk about form over function or look how pretty, especially as it relates to websites.
Yes. In the book, we share an example of Finish Line. And you may have seen the graphics there. And Finish Line is an athletic shoe and apparel company. And so they're an e-commerce company. And when they changed their website to just be very minimalistic, you'll see the graphic on page 116. It shows what the final website looked like. It was a terrible, terrible failure. They basically made it like, it looks almost like a search engine. It almost looks like the front page of Google where you put in an item in the search box and you're supposed to go. Instead of showcasing
all of
their shoes.
With a close-up of a young man's face.
Yes, not even a shoe. Yeah, exactly. It's not even a shoe, or some kind of athletic gear. And so when you prioritize potentially beauty over what is functional, what happens is you could really lose a lot of your sales. And that's exactly what happened to Finish Line. Similar situation happened to me before I started my agency. I worked for an online survey company. And I share this example in the book as well, that I changed radically the way the homepage looked because we had been following the traditional layout of homepages and what was trendy at the time. But there were just too many things on the homepage. And I look at a homepage as sort of a table of contents. It's a place to get you somewhere else. The job is not to stop on the homepage. It's to go somewhere else on the website and make a purchase or convert. And so I tried to slim it down to just the main items that people might need to access. Back then, there was a Microsoft ad says, where do you want to go today? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what our thinking was. Like, well, where do you want to go? Here's your table of contents. And I remember the CTO of the company, who was one of the founders of the online survey company, he came to me and he said, take this down immediately. This is ugly. I don't like it. And I said, that's lovely, Dave. But I said, you know, we're getting 150% more leads this way for free trials. And I said, do you still want me to take it down? And he said, okay, then leave it up. So
great story, you know, too. I loved it.
When you have those examples of where you can take data to say to someone, I know you don't think it's pretty, but it's functional. It's doing the job we really want it to do. It's achieving the goals we have set up for ourselves as an organization. Then it's going to make a much stronger case for you to continue and proceed with this testing to make it even better.
Yeah, that data, it starts to make you bulletproof.
It does.
So, and I came from an advertising background, so that's, let's just say, real subjective. So the client would show it to their spouse and say, no, we think we need to change it. Well, or they would say, yeah, we're not getting as many phone calls. Well, who's calling in? You know, so we never had that, but anyway, now we do. There was another one. It's called availability bias. Now, that's where, like I mentioned earlier, that's basically you're looking at the data you have, but you're not necessarily looking for the data you need. Would that be a correct way to describe it?
Yes, exactly. And so in some of these cases, you know, you may be looking at something like conversion, but really what you need to be looking at is, again, as we mentioned, like it doesn't stop at conversion. That's just because you have that data available to you, easily acceptable. Like, for instance, if you're running a Google Ads campaign, conversions are right there. How convenient. But maybe you don't have the offline sales data there. So it takes a little more work to get there. Just making decisions off of conversions because they're available isn't really the best approach. So you really have to push yourself a little bit with this bias and say, let me go and get the data that I really need and figure out where it is. And in the book, we also try and guide you through where to find that data because yeah, that can be a real challenge.
Yeah. And you may not get it right away, but the one thing that you never want to say out loud is, well, nobody gave me the data. That is not their problem. You need to go find it and start to look for it. And, you know, it's like doing any kind of research or scientific testing where you don't quite know where you're going to find it, but only good things can come from asking those things. And if nothing else, seems to me like it changes their perception of you when you start asking for information like that.
Well, and also remember that they don't always know that you might need it or what you might need it for. They don't work in marketing. They don't know that you may need this data. So when you go to them and ask them for it, first of all, you show an interest in what they're doing. You show an interest in their department and what they're doing and how you can partner with them. That's a huge step forward. So I really challenge marketers to be the ones stepping forward in the organization. It will gain you so much respect that you care about these metrics. And so definitely try and step forward and be the leader in that.
Yes, that is marketing leadership. And we've talked about that in interviews about books like The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader, or more recently, Sway by Christina Del Villar, or The Whole Marketer by Abigail Dixon. Now, the last thing I want to ask you about has to do with Nicolas Cage, but it's really important for marketers to understand this one. Now, we're not talking about all of them, but this one I did want to mention. False causality, and I see it all the time, or correlation is not causation. And just to harken back to another book on the show years ago by Sarah Cooper called 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, if you say at the right time, correlation is not causation, you will definitely be looking smart in a meeting, even if you're not paying attention. You know, you could be sitting there playing Candy Crush. But talk about correlation is not causation and maybe what that has to do with Drownings and Nicolas Cage movies.
Well, on page 120 in the book, we have a lovely example of how Nicolas Cage movies the films that he's appeared in over time correspond to, the line almost matches up perfectly, the number of swimming pool drownings every year. So basically, we're blaming Nicolas Cage for people drowning in swimming pools.
Right.
Again, correlation does not equal causation. I have one I like to use in a lot of my decks, which is Internet Explorer usage makes people suicidal.
Wow, really?
I might actually believe that one. That Internet Explorer.
Or drive them to drink. What is that?
Drive you crazy. Yeah, isn't that crazy? But, you know, there's many of them out there. You can just Google these, and they're so funny to see. All these lines. I have another one that I use with, if you eat margarine, the people in Maine are more likely to get divorced. I mean, just random stuff. But, you know, it's very easy to, especially coming from the world of SEO and working in that area, you know, you see that a lot where we have to make assumptions based on the data because we don't, Google doesn't come out and tell you, hey, everybody, here's the 200 items in our algorithm that you should work on. They don't tell you that. So you have to really make a lot of educated guesses based on the data that you have. And so we talk a lot about correlation and causation in that particular realm of marketing because we have to make educated guesses. So how do we know that we're not accidentally correlating things that really don't have anything to do with one another? And we see it pretty often in that particular area of digital marketing that there's false correlations. So you got to be really careful when you look at your data that you're not making assumptions based on that data that aren't true.
Right.
And testing can really help you with that, to do it multiple times, to take larger swaths of data as well can help you with that. But really, it's a slippery slope. You've got to be very, very careful because it's very easy to fall down that path of going down a path where you are seeing a line and it looks like it might be the reason, but it may not be the reason. So you might want to find some other ways to get at that and to understand truly if it is the cause.
Right. Another one that comes to mind that I've heard of is when ice cream sales go up, there's more shark attacks. And it's not because sharks like ice cream, but people have said, oh, that there's a correlation. Well, no, there's not. It's just that it's warm. And that's when the people are in the ocean.
Right. And they also eat ice cream.
Yeah, and they're eating ice cream. And the sharks are, I think that they may be in warmer, the sharks may like warmer water. So yeah, it's a similar sort of thing. So in the remaining time, I'd like to dig a bit into the campaign framework. And we can't get into all of it, but there are a couple things I wanted to ask about. And just so the listener understands, this whole framework kind of shows you the racetrack you could be going on. And it's in three sections, which are the development phase, the execution phase, and then the analysis phase. Note that it doesn't stop with the execution. The data-first approach, you have to have analysis throughout. And in the development phase, you talk about developing personas, developing content, and then the channels, you know, choosing distribution and communication channels. And then in the execution phase, you've got all the tools you should be using, the data collection, and the testing you should be doing. And this also gives folks, listeners, an idea of some of the other topics in the book that we're not going to be able to talk about. And then in the analysis phase, you talk about attribution, KPIs, key performance indicators, and ROI. So I wanted to focus in on just maybe three of these things. They have to do with the development phase. And these are topics that are of great interest to me. And so for development, you know, normal people want to get right into the, you know, like if it's ready, aim, fire, they want to start firing. They want to get right to the action. They start doing it. And you quoted Abraham Lincoln, who said, "Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first four sharpening the axe." And, you know, another famous quote he had, Janet, was, "The problem with internet quotes is that you can't always depend on their accuracy." Can you believe how prescient that guy was? I mean,
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
He was before his time.
I know. It's just amazing. But let's talk about buyer personas. And One of my favorite books is Buyer Personas by Adele Ravella, which you talk about in this book. You see how excited your book got me? You started mentioning all of my favorite books and all these authors I've been able to interview. The listeners at this point, after 350 interviews, they may be getting tired of me talking about Adele Ravella's book and Buyer Personas. So if you don't mind, can you explain what they are? And, you know, I don't think there's any secret sauce to what we do, but I think this is one of the things that gets you pretty close to it.
Absolutely. Well, it informs everything you do. It's foundational.
Even your products.
To your products, your campaigns, everything that you're doing. And I have to be honest, as a marketer, I was very anti-persona until I met Adele Ravella. And
did she threaten you?
No, she was the nicest person.
I'm kidding.
There was no threatening at all. But her book is amazing.
You know, it is.
And she's, when I heard her speak, we spoke at a conference together quite a few years back before she wrote her book. And I was so impressed with her methodology for developing personas, which centers around understanding the actual buyers. And this isn't really rocket science, but it's saying, you know, let's go and figure out, okay, who are the people who are buying our product? And let's figure out how to get more people just like that. And to build those personas, what she insists on, and I think this is really critical, I came from an online survey software company before I started my agency. And the challenge.
Where you changed the homepage?
Where I changed the homepage radically.
And got away with it.
I got away with it because of data. But when we talk about personas and we talk about building personas, a lot of times companies will just rely on sending out an online survey.
Or asking the sales team and stopping there.
Right. And you know, you can get some anecdotal evidence from them. You can get some from surveys, but not everyone fills out a survey. You think about like your customer base, they're just probably too busy to fill out your survey. So she insists on interviewing the customers. And that is really a key critical part of her development with personas. Most of the personas I had seen prior to using Adele's method, I had seen marketing agencies create these, you know, really hokey personas. Like, this is Jim, and Jim shops at Aldi, and he does this. It was just kind of ridiculous. Yeah. And we're like,
and how do you know?
How do you know he did that? Like, because you just made it up?
Yes.
And so, basically, yeah. And they'd have some hokey picture of some guy, some from you know, stock photography of Jim, and he's, you know, there he is at Aldi. But you know, really, they were not really data informed in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw her method, it's so holistic in these interview processes and talking with sales and using potentially online surveys as well. Putting all of that information together is so critical to really an informed, correct persona of who your buyer really is.
Mm-hmm. Just today, I was recommending that book and sending a link to a listener, Thomas Buchanan in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a friend of the show. And he just started a new sales job. And he, you know, I was saying, you know, the more you can understand your customer, the better. And I mean, I love her book. We've had some extra training from her on it. But if you just do what's in the book, and even if you can't read the book, folks, just go to her website, buyerpersona.com, or Google 5 Rings of Insight. And there's just these 5 things that if you can understand them just a little bit better than your competition, it's amazing how you're going to break through. And, you know, quick personal experience, we do this with new clients. And we tell them what we're going to do. And after we've done these 20, 30-minute interviews with maybe a half dozen of these customers, we come back and it's part of the process, the client will say one of two things, if not both. They'll say, wow, you really understand our customers. Then the other thing that they'll often say is, I forgot how much goes on in their world before they get to us.
Yeah.
But it kind of gives you an unfair advantage. So the other thing that is in this that I mentioned was the let me mention one other thing. You mentioned Jay Akunzo, author of Break the Wheel, also on the Marketing Book Podcast. This is the name dropper episode, just so people know. But I love that book. Love Jay. And if he had this in his book, I must have forgotten it. He writes, you would never feed salad to a lion.
Yeah. I thought that was a great quote.
It is. And I mentioned it this week to, I think it was a client or somebody else I was talking to, and they got it right away. They go, ah, yes, that's it. That's it. You don't want to feed salad to a lion. And I think a lot of marketing content, at least, is trying to feed salad to a lion. It's just a real mismatch. But as it relates to developing content assets, there was something in here that you mentioned, a guy named Jeff Gregory, who's an SEO analyst at Custom Inc.
Yes.
And he mentions three gauges they use to conceive and measure content. So all content, they look at traffic, links, and conversions. Can you explain what he's talking about, where they ask, does it go through one of those three hoops?
Yeah. So actually, he said the way we consider our content successful is it has to meet two of these three criteria. So it has to traffic to the site, because he's an SEO guy. So his focus is getting organic traffic to the site and also then having them convert. So when he thinks about traffic, he wants to have content that's going to bring traffic in organically. Second, links. In SEO, of course, links are really important, inbound links to your content, because they help your SEO ranking in Google and other search engines. And then the third is conversions. So in his case, he doesn't necessarily need conversions to say that a piece of content was successful, because if it brings him traffic and links, it's bringing people to the site. Mm-hmm. And so that's really important. It's a KPI, right? It gets people in, and then he can also close the deal for conversion with some other piece of content potentially. But two of those three things have to be in place, or else what good was the content? It did him no good. Mm-hmm. And so they have to really analyze, is it worth creating a piece of content like this again?
Yeah. And it gets you out of the thing that we talked about earlier, like, wow, look at all that great website traffic. Great. what does it do for me? Now, the other thing about content I want to mention is you talk about when you're creating content, consider what questions are asked along your buyer's journey that can inform them along the path. Now, kind of like with Adele, one of my favorite books is by our fellow Virginia resident, Marcus Sheridan, author of They Ask You Answer. I've talked about that book a lot. I've interviewed him about the first and second edition of his book. Again, the listeners are probably getting tired of me talking about it. So maybe if you could expand on that and explain why answering your prospective customers' questions is so helpful for the content. And what I mean by that is, rather than just talking all about yourself, which seems to be most websites that I look at.
Right. Well, and so from me coming from a world of SEO and search engine optimization, what people are putting into search engines is not that they want to buy a CRM tool. That's not what they're putting in. They're wanting questions answered for them about, for instance, like a marketer might ask, you know, how do I marry sales and marketing? How do I improve that relationship? That's what people go to search engines for primarily, is to have questions answered. And so when you're creating content, your opportunity there is to create content that they need and want, so that they find it and come to you, and you're seen as a subject matter expert on the topic. So, and then they'll continue to come back to you and trust you with more. Mm-hmm. So, but that's where that persona building is so important. Once you build those personas, you got to ask yourself, what are the questions they have? And you can't just say that to yourself. This is where Adele's work comes in.
You
have
to ask
them, right?
Talk to them.
That's right. That's right. What are their questions? And sales can help with this as well, because sales knows what are some common questions I get on a sales call. And they can tell you what type of content would help them to inform this prospect and make them a customer. So definitely be asking them what are the questions that they need. But there's also multiple ways you can find out too. Some topics is you can just even Google it and see what's up there. What types of topics are coming up? There's lots of tools out there where you can see related types of searches. Mm-hmm. Google does this too. And you can just see, well, what are some other questions people might be asking around this topic, so that you can fill that void with the right content that's going to answer their questions. And I know Anne Handley talks about it a lot too. She's the queen of content. Love Anne. And she will say, you know, don't give them a bunch of garbage that they don't need. Answer their question. Help them solve a problem. And that's how they're going to trust you as a company.
Yeah. And if they don't find what they're looking for, they're not going to keep digging. They're going to go hit the back button and go find some other website that is offering that information.
It's just too easy to do.
Yes.
You know?
I have to laugh. So the background, the backstory for Marcus is that he had a pool company here in Virginia. I think they started it around 2001 or so. And then the real estate crash in 2008 rolled around and people didn't want pools and almost had to declare bankruptcy. And they had been spending a lot of money on advertising. And like a lot of entrepreneurs, he was stubborn, just like you and I are probably. and they said, you need to give up your house. And he's like, no, I got four small kids. I can't do that. And he hung on. And I think they had to lay off some folks. But he said, all right, I don't have any money left for advertising. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to answer every question I have ever gotten from a customer, and I'm going to put it on my website. Questions that nobody wanted to answer, like, what does a pool cost? When is a fiberglass pool not a good idea? Fiberglass versus concrete. All these kinds of questions. And within a year, now this is a while back, ancient history as we marketers say, he was the number one pool site in the world. And all these manufacturers are like, who is this guy in Warsaw, Virginia, who's beating us on the organic search results? Well, it turned his business around, and people, by answering the questions, they would the people's trust went up, their fear of doing business went down, and he goes on and on. But it's amazing. And then at one point, the New York Times wrote an article about him and how he turned his pool company around. And I think the headline was something like, a revolutionary approach to marketing, : answer your customers' questions.
Yeah. And you know, you could even do this if you're an e-commerce company. I think one of the lazy things e-commerce marketers do is just use the information that's provided by the manufacturer in their page about the product detail. My friend Rob Snell runs a company called Gundog Supply. And what he and his brother Steve do really successfully is they go out and actually field test these products. So he has a lot of products for like hunters and so forth. Oh, wow. And they'll go out and shoot their own video and show like, here's how this works in the field. Here's why I recommend it. Here's what works well. Here's what doesn't. And so because they're field testing this and providing additional content that's important to the customer, it helps increase their sales and it helps them stand out amongst the competition when, you know, hundreds of retailers might be selling this product. They can stand out because they have additional content that's not just your standard verbiage that you're getting from the manufacturer.
Yes, gundogsupply.com. It's great. And actually, there's a gun dog asleep on the floor right behind me. I don't take him hunting, but golden retriever. I think that's why they came about. And I'm looking at, they even have dog beds on here. I think he might like one of those since he seems to like to sleep. You know, another listener to the show, Steve Sheinkoff, CEO of Yale Appliance up in Boston. They're selling appliances at various stores, and they have taken on a massive content approach. I think they're a client of Marcus's for years now, but they've done the same thing where they said, in fact, when I was recently having to buy a new washer and a dryer, I was Googling this stuff. His website was coming up, and I was reading it and understanding, oh, this was a good model. That's not a good model. This is what I should look for. Okay. And I told him later, I said, if I could buy from you, I would, but they don't send their products down here to Virginia. So two other things I quickly want to ask you about the book. We've only been able to scratch the surface. You mention on page 169, a 2019 LinkedIn study. And I found this interesting. It found that digital marketers are often measuring ROI too quickly. Too quickly. Can you explain what's going on there? That's very interesting. And I think it's something marketers need to understand and be able to explain why.
Let me tell you that about every company I've ever spoken with, when I bring them on board to my agency, I'll ask them, how long is your sales cycle? And do you know what the answer always is? 30 days. That is the answer every time. And I'm like, that's not possible. That's just not possible for every product. It's just not possible for every service. Marketers don't always understand the length of a sales cycle. And the platforms that we have available to us that we're using in digital marketing, like Google, PPC, like Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera, they typically measure conversion on a 30-day basis. But the reality is that for some of us, and depending on what industry we're in, the sales cycle is actually a lot longer than 30 days. So if you're measuring on a 30-day sales cycle, and let's say I had one client whose sales cycle was 2 years, they had a very complex insurance application for insurance companies that the IT department had to be involved in for that purchase. The marketing team had to be involved in it. It was a very large type of sale that involved a lot of different constituencies within an organization, and it would take 2 years to get it through to get something sold. You really have to understand as a marketer what your sales cycle is on average, and it is not 30 days. Even in my own agency, it's 3 months.
Right.
So,
but who is telling you 30 days, and why are they saying that? Do they just not know any better?
They just don't know. They haven't measured it, and perhaps they haven't even spoken with sales. And sometimes sales gets it wrong too. They're making an assumption, and that's not really the situation. So, for instance, let's say somebody comes to your website and they go around to all this different content, and they've been there for maybe 60 days looking at all your content. Maybe they don't become a lead till after 60 days, and then at the 60-day mark, they go over, become a sales qualified lead, and sales has them in their camp, and they close in 30 days. So to sales, that's a 30-day sales cycle. But in reality, it was a 90-day sales cycle, right? Because it took bringing them in to your site and showing them all this content to get them to become a lead, to get them to go to sales. So if you look at things only in a 30-day conversion window, that isn't always an accurate way to look at how long you need to be talking with that client, that prospect, to get them to become a sale.
Yeah. So marketers, please be careful just accepting blindly what the salespeople tell you about what your sales cycle is. Ask to see the data. Don't ask how long the sales cycle is. Dig in there. The last thing I wanted to ask about is because you've got a whole section on how to staff a department or what kind of people to look for and how to determine if they're going to be a fit, and even some of the questions you ask at interviews, which I thought was terrific. Let's talk about hard skills and soft skills, okay? And if you could explain what they are. You write that most experienced employees are not lacking hard skills, but rather soft skills.
Absolutely. And so, you can see a lot of the hard skills right directly on their resume, or you may see, accomplishments that they have that reflect those hard skills. Like I am certified in Google AdWords, right? Now, okay. That would be a hard skill. Soft skills are more like problem solving. Tenacity is one that I think is really important. Mm. Flexibility and adaptability. Mm-hmm. Curiosity.
Yes.
Right? You want someone who's curious and wants to learn more. And this growth mindset of saying, I always want to be doing better. I'm not really willing to settle. I want to try, keep trying, keep plugging away and make this better. And those are things that are difficult to measure. They're difficult to know. So certainly, I think in an interview process, there are opportunities to ask people how they feel about certain things. But you have to be careful how you address those questions, because people are going to tell you what you want to hear. Actions speak louder than words. So once you get them into the position, if they've told you what you wanted to hear, they may or may not really reflect some of those skill sets. So you have to really keep an eye on who are the folks in my organization that really do have those soft skills like curiosity and growth mindset and that tenacity and adaptability, who can grow with my organization and grow in these roles.
Right. So if you're ever interviewing at Marketing Mojo, and Janet asks, why do you want to work here? Here's what you don't want to say, which I believe does not represent a growth mindset. Don't say, as an expert in search engine optimization, I want to bring my expertise to the company. And if I'm not mistaken, that was an undergraduate who hadn't even graduated. And you write, well, this was likely a synthetic answer that would appeal to some companies. This student was interviewing for a position at a search engine optimization agency and was being interviewed by an SEO expert with over 20 years of experience. We ended the interview there. So I gather that you thought he thought he knew it all. He didn't have a little more humility that there's so much more to learn. I mean, if he had said something like, I'm very interested in this topic and I think I could learn so much here, that would have been more of a growth mindset answer. And the other thing that I found so interesting was you mentioned Sarah Blakely, the woman who created Spanx.
Yes.
And she talked about how her dad, every night, didn't say what, I might have said to my kids, did you have a good day or what'd you learn? He would ask, what did you fail at today? That was so amazing. And from that, yeah. She learned it's not only that it's not okay to fail, that you should be experimenting. And I would say by doing that, you're going to learn the most. I learn the most when I have screwed something up.
Absolutely.
So,
and in fact, my husband used to say, he used to work with me at Marketing Mojo, and he said, the key is learning the, you know, have 100 ways to do something, learning what the 99 ways that you shouldn't do it are. That's really what you build in expertise. The expertise is about learning all the things you shouldn't do
right,
rather than
exactly.
all the things you should.
Yes. So you had to let him go?
No, I didn't let him go.
Okay. Don't need to get into that. All right.
Let's talk about something important.
If readers took only one thing away from the book, Janet, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope that right now, today, the first thing that you're going to do is you're going to start learning what you need to measure, figure out how to move towards ROI measurement. And again, baby steps. You don't mm-hmm. have to do it all today. But what are the things that you can do today? And then ensuring that you're answering the real questions the organization has, your company has. So these are about business goals. That's ultimately what you need to know. And if you don't know that, it is your CEO's responsibility to make sure the organization understands those goals. So if you're not getting that answer, ask the CEO, what are the goals you're setting up? Or ask the sales team, what are your sales goals here? So understand that better. So start that conversation.
Great answer. I'm so glad you mentioned that because it made me realize a couple questions I forgot to ask you. And one is, I've chatted with marketing folks or companies that come to us, and they don't, there have been a few that just do not know what the goals are. And there have even been some business owners or CEOs that can't tell me that. What can a marketer do if they're at a company where they can't find out what some of the business goals are? Can they maybe start to help them develop the goals?
Absolutely. And, you know, really what we want to see is marketing have a seat at the table.
Yes.
To have a conversation about this. So what you can do is you can take the data that you have and you can help suggest what the goals should be. You know, you have a lot of data, even though you may not have all of the data, you have mm-hmm. a lot of data at your disposal that you can use to help guide the company if the company doesn't know yet what those goals should be. And you can make suggestions based on what you have in your own data. So you can be a real asset to the company in that way as well, as really helping those goals get developed and being a part of that.
Absolutely. Marketing leadership, you will be a better marketer. They will perceive you differently. You'll be contributing a lot more value to your company. So Janet, what books have most inspired your working career?
Well, I think I may even mention this in the book. One of the reasons we asked David Meerman Scott to write the foreword is when he wrote the book, The New Rules of Marketing and PR, mm-hmm. it was a game changer for me as a marketer. It really made me look at marketing in a different way. And we hope our book is revolutionary in the way that David's was for us. Certainly, that is a really important one. Landing Page Optimization by Tim Ash is a great one, mm-hmm. especially when you are learning how to do testing and getting into that testing mindset. Mm-hmm. And another one I really like, I don't think I mentioned it in our book, but Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with Dan Ariely's work, but I love his work. And I'm a real Dan Ariely fangirl.
He teaches at Duke also?
Yes, he does. Yeah, used to, I believe, be at the University of Chicago, but now he's at Duke. And mm-hmm. And his work is just really fascinating because it looks at buyer behavior mm-hmm. and things that you wouldn't necessarily you would assume one thing, but as a marketer, you have to really think a little bit differently because sometimes buyer behavior isn't as predictable as you might think. So those are three that I think really have transformed me as a marketer over the years. I think they're really fantastic books.
Oh, they absolutely are. Let me just add in, let me just pile on. I mentioned earlier David Meerman Scott, New Rules of Marketing and PR, one of the two books that have had the biggest impact on my career. You know, I came from an ad background, and after I got out of the Army years ago, I read Ogilvy on Advertising, and I said, that is what I want to do. And I went off to New York and worked in advertising forever. And then that started to change. That gravy train kind of came to a stop. You know, advertising is a shadow of its former self. And I started thinking, gosh,
What am I going to do when I grow up? And I stumbled upon a copy, an early copy of his book, and I read that. And like you said, it was a game changer. I felt like I had a second bite at the career apple, and I pivoted that way and haven't looked back. And such a fan. And I would think, you said it, but I was just going to say, I think there are marketers who will say, you know, back in 2021, I got a hold of data-first marketing, and that really cleared a lot up for me. That really helped me. You may not realize it right away, but it's one of those, I think, game-changing career books. And Tim Ash, a great guy. Don't believe a word he says about me, though, because, Janet, those charges were dropped. Those are absolutely fantastic. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading, maybe now that you've got a little bit more time?
Oh, you know, I have so much free time. You know, I am a voracious reader. I love to read books. And one that I'm reading right now, I actually just finished one. These are not necessarily marketing books, but self-improvement books to try and be more successful.
Any book,
Any book, yeah. This is, I just finished The Miracle Morning for Entrepreneurs, which is about, you know, getting up every day. I've had several friends in mastermind groups recommend early rising and to take that advantage of having quiet, which in most of our lives we're so busy and things just get out of hand by the end of the day. There's so many things to deal with. But taking that time in the morning to invest in yourself, basically, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe reading during that time, exercising, doing things that make you feel like you've accomplished something already in the day. Mm-hmm. And it makes your day much more successful. So, but from that book, I also saw one that was called Profit First by, I'm going to get his name. I'm going to mispronounce it. I know Mike Michalowicz, I think is his name.
I think it's Michalowicz. And I'm interviewing him next week, actually. Yeah.
Really?
Well, not about that book. He's got a new book coming out called Get Different.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'll have to get that one too. Yeah. His book so far is fantastic. I love his writing style. It's very direct and very humorous.
And did you know that he's a Virginia Tech graduate?
I didn't know that. Oh, that's great. Well, I'll have to connect with him.
See, when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, there's a lot of really worthless trivia to keep track of. So you're welcome.
But Profit First is about making sure you make profit for your agency, for your company, and that you set that aside. It's a really great concept. Uh-huh. And I learned about that through the Miracle Morning book as well. So I was real interested. I'm about halfway through Mike's book, and I love it so far. It's been fantastic.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, I've heard about Miracle Morning from other agency owner friends. Maybe I should read it. Doggone it. Now you just added to my reading list. Well, Janet Driscoll-Miller, how can one lucky listener win a copy of your book?
I'm glad you asked. So if you go to this bit.ly that I'm going to read off free now, there's a form there you can fill out to be entered into a drawing for the book. It's bit.ly, so bit.ly/marketingbookpodcast. And that's all one word, marketing book podcast, all lowercase.
I like the sound
of
it.
Just swish it all together, and there you have it.
Yeah. Well, and we'll also include a link to it on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com if that's any easier for the listener. But at that page, your as they call it, as the kids call it, the show notes page, we're going to include links to your LinkedIn profile and your agency website, and we're going to include links to all the books that I've mentioned that where there were interviews on the podcast, including Scott Brinker's, which I didn't mention. He wrote an excellent book called Hacking Marketing. But basically all the links that – everything linkable, we're going to link to it. And to the listener, I would like to ask you a big favor. If you don't do anything else, please reach out to Janet Driscoll-Miller and thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. She and Julia have worked a long time on this book, and it really, really gets the guests excited on the show when they hear from listeners like you. Even if you're just going to say thank you for putting up with that knucklehead for an hour and a half, it sounds like a great book. And in matter of fact, if you just have some questions, message her. I'll have your Twitter link and all that. But she's not hard to get in touch with. She seems like a really nice person, and
I mean, you can almost guarantee that because she did go to James Madison University.
Did go to JMU.
Yeah. So it's actually required by law that you're nice, like my son. So, and for the listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The book is Data First Marketing, How to Compete and Win in the Age of Analytics. The authors are Janet Driscoll-Miller and Julia Lim. Janet, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating that you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.